This is a film that's been doing the rounds on the internet. I think it's been watched thousands of times or millions of times. And, you know, we're showing this so that we can put our perspective on the various economic theories that are being propounded in it. So hopefully, I think that's unfortunately that's all we can do is show it on here. So I'll just set it going.
Can I just quickly ask, following up from the points you made, what is the party's attitude towards the fact that, well, I probably do know the answer, but there's quite a lot of direct action going on. And the people involved in that are not interested in politics, political parties. The transition movement, for example, which is designed to encourage resilience in readiness for a time of some collapse. It's limited in its appeal, and it does nothing to attack the seats of wealth and power. But that's where a lot of people are putting their energy, in the occupation movement.
Well, you say that because that's a good transition to this film, because you know, we're showing this film not because we agree with it. In fact, there's only one thing in this film, so it's a warning, that's right. It's wrong historically, and it's wrong theoretically. The only thing they get right is the date the Bank of England was founded in 1694. Everything else in this film is wrong. But the reason why we're showing it is the ideas in this film are popular amongst the occupied. I've got the Occupy Times here, and there's three currency crank articles in here. So that you say they're not political, but somebody is saying, you know, there's something wrong with this banking system. That's all that's wrong. All we need to do is have currency reform. So this is an argument that we need to deal with, because the conclusions of what these people that are writing in here are saying about currency is you don't need to change society as a whole. All you need to do is change the banking system or change the money system. And that's
a nicer form of...
But, I mean, this film, they really think that bankers can create money out of thin air. And there's you can laugh at the point, actually, if you can see it. They have a banker with a top hat. And he waves a wand and produces money out of it instead of a rabbit, and it keeps on. It actually calls it the banker's magic hat. Well, you want to watch all 40 minutes of it,
Who's put this? Who made?
Oh yeah, it's a Canadian man called Paul.
What's Grignon?
Well, I suppose if he's a French Canadian, he's pronounced Grignon. But I expect he's called Grignon.
Is he attached to? Is he just an individual?
No, he is attached to a movement. He supports monetary reform, probably of the social credit type of monetary reform, where instead of the banks issuing money, the government should issue the money.
The government taking over the banks, except for nationalising banks.
But they want money to be issued by the government, but the banks can continue doing other things. But they want money to be issued. Well, that's the argument. They think that banks can create money, and I'll be explaining afterwards that isn't the case. So they've got a solution to an imaginary problem. Anyway, you'll see the.
Is it linked to like an economic theory?
Well, yes. He's a Canadian, and in Canada, this social credit movement, which developed in England before the last World War in the 1920s and 1930s, said that what was wrong with the system was, you know, banking and money, and the social credit movement that was quite strong in Canada.
Yes, they even have a provincial government.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's Saskatchewan.
So that's where he's coming from. That's the theory that he's starting from.
Okay. Yeah, right. Apologies for the improvisation
and the crowd noise.
Yeah, and the crowd noise. I think they're trying to match the Quebec noise. I think that we've had before. Okay, Adam, do you want to...
Yeah, I don't spend much because you've been watching a film for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
As I said, this is a completely different analysis from us. It's what's wrong is the monetary system, and what's wrong is interest. Well, we say what's wrong is the whole economic system. It's a system of production for profit. Now, there's some very obvious things which are wrong in that thing. For instance, to start at the stuff at the end, they say... what is the origin of interest? So you can only pay interest by borrowing more money. But, I mean, interest comes out of future production. If, if it's successful. And I mean, but that theory there that they put forward, that you have to keep borrowing more and more, is the theory of collapse, which is held not so much by these people, but by, you know, other people like the Zeitgeist movement. I mean, to go back to the beginning, you know, this man is quite proud of his Goldsmith's tale. But that's all it is. It's a tale. It's complete, well, almost complete fiction. If you can remember what he said, you get the impression that every medieval town had a goldsmith, and people put their money there, and that it they issued notes which were spent in the local market and so on and so forth. I mean, that's not the case. There were goldsmith bankers, but they only existed in one part of the world for a short period of time. They existed in England, in London, in fact, from about the middle of the 17th century until the Bank of England was formed. And they didn't act, in fact, in the way which is, you know, which has been suggested. You know, that they took money in and then lent out, issued more notes than they had gold in their vaults. I mean, what we know about the goldsmiths bankers comes from a writer in the 18th century called Richard. Well, I don't know how to pronounce it, but we've got a French person to back there. But he was Irish, but he was called Cantillon. But I suppose in French he was called Cantillon. But you know, he wrote a book called Essay on the Nature of Trade, and he describes, you know, what actually happened with the goldsmith bankers. I mean, the background is the English Civil War, when, you know, before that, rich people put their gold and silver and other valuables in the Royal Mint. But in the course of the war, the King Charles seized the money in the Royal Mint. He issued pieces of paper saying he's going to pay them back, but he didn't get the chance. And so after that, rich people said, we're not letting him put money in the Royal Mint again. So they started putting the money to with Goldsmith. And this is what this man Richard Cantillon writes about the situation. He says, if 100 economic gentlemen or proprietors of land who put by every year money from their savings to buy land on occasion deposit each one 10,000 ounces of silver, so that these people, the silver that was in the vault and not gold, 10,000 ounces of silver, with a goldsmith or banker in London, to avoid the trouble of keeping this money in their houses and the thefts which might be made of it, they will take from them notes payable on demand. Often they will leave their money there for a long time, and even when they have made some purchase, they will give notice to the banker some time in advance to have their money ready when the formalities and legal documents are complete. In these circumstances, the banker will often be able to lend 90,000 ounces of the 100,000 ounces he owes throughout the year, and will only need to keep in hand 10,000 ounces to meet all withdrawals. And he goes on to say that in this circumstances, you know, when you're dealing with these type of wealthy people, they only need to keep one-tenth of deposit. But then he goes on, if you're dealing with traders and other people, you need to keep as much as a half or two-thirds. And it's true that these notes, these receipts did circulate, but it acquired a high degree of trust. And if anybody suspected bankers were doing what he says is a regular practice, there would immediately be a run on that bank, and his credit would be ruined. So, I mean, there were goldsmith bankers, but they existed for a short period of time, and they didn't behave in that particular way. And now moving on. There are lots of quotes which Pat tried to read out. Most of them were, some of them were dubious, like the one from Rothschild. And because how would you know what Rothschild has said if he said something like that? But some did a garden party with a notebook and copied it down. It's just anti-Semitism. And similar, that Canadian Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, was a notorious anti-Semite. But anyway, we can produce quotes. They quote the chairman of the Midland Bank, McKenna. We can produce the chairman of some other bank who will say the opposite. So quotes don't solve anything. But having said that, I'm going to give a quote from Paul Krugman, who's a leading American economist, who's often on the television and the radio. This is what he writes. As I read various stuff on banking, comments here, but also various writings here and there, I often see the view that banks can create credit out of thin air. There are vehement denials of the proposition that bank lending is limited by their deposits or that the monetary base plays any important role. This is wrong. First of all, any individual bank does in fact have to lend out money it receives in deposits. Bank loan officers can't just issue checks out of thin air like employees of any financial intermediary. They must buy assets with funds they have on hand. I mean, he says that that's what most people think. What most people think is right. I mean, it's common sense. What banks are is that they are middlemen. They're intermediaries between people, between savers, if you like, and spenders, between people who've got money which they don't want to spend for the time being, and which they then lend to other people who want money. And the source of the funds, the source of the money which banks in this country lend, there are two main sources. One is ordinary depositors like you and me and other small businesses and so on, and that's called retail. And then there's a wholesale one, which is what they borrow from the money market, other financial institutions, and investors. So that's the source of the money which banks lend. Now, you only need to see that banks can't lend money out of thin air. They can't just lend what they haven't got. All you need to do is to read carefully the financial pages of the newspapers. I've got here about four cuttings over the last few months. I mean, the first thing is that banks and building societies are in competition with each other to get these funds. I mean, that's why they're offering all these not very attractive rates these days. But what they're competing to say, look, lend your money here instead of there. I mean, here's something about the Nationwide, which in fact is a building society, not a bank. As it says, banks and building societies are competing for the savings from ordinary depositors because funding from institutional investors has partly dried up because of the euro problem. And it says that Nationwide traditionally seeks about 20-30% of its funding from the wholesale sources, with the rest coming from its 12 million savers. But I mean, building societies have got more restrictions than banks. In banks, they probably get more from the wholesale market, which is the money market. This other item is about Santander, which has decided to have the opposite policy to Nationwide. They've decided to rely more and more on the wholesale market, rather than depositors, and they've let depositors go. But it says here, competition for deposits was intense, it said, leading other banks to accept losses in their quest to attract savings. In the climate, wholesale funding has become relatively more attractive. So, I mean, Tesco is going to start a bank up, but they're waiting for the law to change. So it's easier to transfer from one bank to another. But I mean, they're all competing against each other for funds. Why would they do this if they didn't need funds? It's as I say, if you read the newspapers carefully, you can see that it's only theorists and fringe thinkers like Paul Grinion that think that banks can lend what they haven't got and create money out of thin air. Now the final thing on this actually is something which is in fact, it says that a new idea is coming up that you can, with the internet and things like that, you don't need an intermediary. Somebody wants money, they can say I need money and look up on the internet, and somebody else says I've got money, so that there wouldn't be any need for banks at all, because as I say, banks are essentially a middleman, and I mean, they make their profits out of it was actually said in there at one point, they make the profits out of the difference between the rate of interest that they pay to savers and the rate of interest that they charge to borrowers. I mean that is in fact isn't the whole of their, that's their income. You know, after the profits are what is left after they've spent money on paying their staff and you know, computer equipment and other expenses. But I mean that is the source of the income and profits of banks. It isn't creating money out of nothing and then letting out of interest. It's not like that. And at the moment, they're being squeezed. You know, this is the thing here about the Halifax. It's raising its rate of interest it charges to people that it's given mortgages to. But the reason they give for this is that they have to pay more to get the funding to pay these mortgages. And it's been argued that it's been forced by market conditions. The change acknowledges that the cost of funding a mortgage in today's market remains significantly higher than the longer term average, the Halifax said. The increase to the rate reflects the fact that raising money through retail savings and the wholesale markets is currently very expensive by historical standards. There's a similar one by the Royal Bank of Scotland. And here's what's his name, Robert Preston, commenting on the situation of Lloyds Bank's report, which is called Big Income Squeeze. And what he says, perhaps the most striking trend is that what's called the interest margin, which is the difference between these two rates of interest, the difference between the interest Lloyd charges for loans and what it pays out as interest, has shrunk and will shrink again this year. The interest margin fell from 2.21% to 2.0% and is expected to fall by a similar amount in 2012. One of the main reasons for this income squeeze is the rising cost of banks borrowing money on wholesale markets or from other financial institutions at a time when the banks can charge for loans to customers remains under pressure. Lloyds is becoming less and less dependent on these reliable wholesale sources of funding as part of the strategic effort to make it safer. So, the financial pages just take it for granted that this is how banks operate. They're middlemen and they get funds either from depositors or from the money market, and they make their income. It's the difference between the interest that they charge savers and that they that they pay to savers and that they charge borrowers. And if the rate of interest which they get money goes up, they have to put up the rate of interest. If the theory there was true, they wouldn't need to worry about things like that. They could just just create money out of thin air. I think people should rely on their own initial reaction to this. The theory that banks can make money out of thin air is so ridiculous and so silly that it can't be true. I mean, and it isn't true. Now, as I say, this is the an analysis that's made by some people in the Occupy movement, people in Zeitgeist. It's also made by right-wing anti-Semites and people like the UKIP party and like that. They have this theory. So they think that the way out of the current crisis and the way to solve society's problems, including in this case ecological problems, is to reform the monetary system and to get rid of interest. Now we know, in actual fact, that's what they want to do. Except for abolishing interest, already exists now. I mean, banks can't create money out of nothing, and most money is in fact created, by the government. So, what they want is actually the situation of the present time. But we know, as socialists, that in fact that is not going to solve the problem at all. In fact, if they try to abolish interest, it would probably make things worse within the capitalist system. Now, our analysis is that what's wrong is the whole system of production for the market with a view to profit. I mean, once you've got that, various economic laws come into operation, which operate as if they were impersonal forces, and governments can't overcome them. And this is the cause of the various problems which people face. Now, our conclusion is, in that case, you don't need monetary reform. What you need is a change in the basis of society, a change from what we've got today, where productive resources are owned by rich individuals or by corporations or by states. End that and have common ownership and democratic control of resources, But that would mean then you could produce things purely and simply for use. So you wouldn't need money. You could have a system of free distribution or free access, and the principle, you know, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. So there wouldn't be any money. So if you like, our solution to all these monetary problems is a system of society in which money would be unnecessary because it would be redundant. I say the purpose of showing this film was to show how widespread these ideas are, and we need to be able to argue against them.
There's another thing that sort of people might have been aware of recently, is this Bitcoin idea.
Mm.
Does that fit in with the cranky money ideas, or is it a separate endeavour type thing?
Well, on another film that he's done, he has an idea where you can't save anything. So you have to, if you've got money, you have to put it under your bed, and that interest can only be paid in kind. So if you're a farmer and you grow corn, you can pay interest in corn, but not in money. But I mean, he has a system of electronic money, but it's not the same as this Bitcoin thing. I can't remember. I mean, I did study Bitcoin thing at one time, but it seems to be a thing which is on the internet. And it can be used for money laundering and all sorts of things, because is it possible to trace where the payments came from? I mean, that's not the intention of the people they want to set up a monetary system independently of the payment system, if you like, independently of the government. It just happens to be that the people that can benefit from this are drug dealers and other people that want to launder money.
Anyone have any questions? Yeah, Sandy.
I've got a question, yeah. I'm well versed in that idea of how money is from the zeitgeist.
Yes, they do that, yeah.
And so now I'm wondering, because I could never figure it out. It always baffled me, I kept thinking, and whenever it's explained, I couldn't understand it. I just couldn't understand it because I couldn't see it. Especially this, the borrower signs a piece of paper that then becomes something that is, and the amount is entered on the ledger or whatever, and then this money is then paid back to the bank in instalments, monthly instalments, by the borrower, and so therefore it's complete profit.
Because the money came
from nothing.
That's the theory, yeah. That's their theory, yeah.
So, I thought, but I still couldn't grasp it. And I think anything that you just can't grasp, you can't see, somewhere in there, it's not quite true.
Hmm.
But my question is, why would this theory come about? I mean, what is the benefit? Who's it benefiting? And why? And where was it got from? Is it been made up, or does it come from somewhere else?
Well, you could argue that if you're a capitalist with a factory and you want to borrow money, you go to the bank to borrow money, and you have to pay part of the profits you make to the bank as interest. So that the people that would be interested in getting rid of interest would be industrial corporations, because I mean they could then keep, if they could get interest free loan, they could keep all the profits they make for themselves. So you could see that this sort of historically an antagonism between industrial capitalists and financial capitalists. That would be a sort of attributed to some sort of interest. But I mean, who thought up the theory? I mean, the theory goes right back to the, to the 19th century when banking did appear to be mysterious and people had all sorts of, ideas about it. But you mentioned zeitgeist. Now it's true that zeitgeists do adhere to this theory, but they don't need to really, because their case doesn't have to rest on that. But when we mentioned this film in the Socialist Standard, Paul Grignion objected to our criticism, and he said, "You're as bad as zeitgeist. You want to abolish money, because he doesn't want to abolish money." But I mean, the zeitgeist case would still be valid, even if they didn't have this particular theory to back it up. I mean, they're right that the, you know, solution is to have a society or a system without money. But you don't need to base the case for that on theories like that, though, except, you know, they do... well, they are committed to a collapse theory, and that is the basis of the theory that the system will collapse.
Is it that they just don't understand it? Or
well, yes. I think they don't understand it, yes. But, I mean, to come back to... you know, they say, or he says, that money is created whenever a bank makes a loan, because, I mean, that IOU is the money. Well, in that case, what about a pawnbroker? You know, are they going to have a theory that pawnbrokers, because they do exactly the same as that person says that the you know, bankers do? They do exactly the same. They do it essentially the same. Somebody comes along and they deposit something, and they have an IOU, and the pawnbroker gives them money. Well, where does the pawnbroker get the money from? The pawnbroker. Everybody admits that pawnbrokers have to have money before they can make loans, but you know, so that argument is invalid. I mean, banks do behave in that way. They do have IOUs, but the money that they make available for the person that's taking out the loan, they have to have in the first place. I mean,
they don't quite have to have it, do they? I mean, especially with the overnight banking.
Okay. Yes. But they have to get it very. They have to get it very quickly. Otherwise, they get caught out. Yeah. Well, that's what this Paul Krugman was saying. The argument with him and his critics was, you know, they say, the bank can make a loan, and then they can rush to the money market and get the money, or they can expect that the money they've made in the loan, somebody else will then deposit in them. But so it's not quite, that argument isn't quite as crude as the argument that's made there, that they just have to, you know, write a cheque out of thin air. At least these other people that Krugman was arguing with have to admit that they have to get the money somehow and fairly quickly, otherwise they'll come unstuck.
Can I ask you about fractional reserve banking?
Yes.
Now, from your point of view, either it is a phrase which some misguided people believe in, but it's a complete fantasy and it doesn't actually exist at all, or it means something different.
Yes.
And if it does mean something and it means something different, I didn't really get what it is you think it means.
Well, yes, I read rather quickly what this quote from that historical thing about the Goldsmith Bank, fractional reserve banking, or banks have fractional reserves, it does exist. It means that when somebody deposits, as in this case, what was it, 100,000 ounces of silver, the bank, because the bank knows that not everybody's going to come and withdraw that money at the same time, they can work out what is safe, you know, to lend out. But what it means, if somebody comes and puts £100, you know, deposit, the bank can lend out only a part of that and keep, say, in this particular case, 10%, which is a fraction, as a cash reserve. That's what the fractional reserve is. But these currency cranks, they say when somebody comes along and puts £100 in, the bank can then lend £900. So fractional reserve banking, you know, does exist, but banks can only have to maintain a proportion of the deposits as cash, and they can convert the others into loans and investments. So I think originally the term fractional reserve banking was used by an economic policy that governments pursued in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, there is no legal limit in England now to the amount of cash a bank has to hold, but it was for a long period 8%. So the government thought we can have a cut back on bank lending, we increase the thing from 8% to 9%. Or if we want to encourage bank lending, we increase we decrease this reserve from 8% to 7%. That's what fractional reserve banking originally meant. But I mean, as we know, they don't. That's not the policy they, the central bank pursues now. They try to influence directly the interest rates. I mean that so fractional reserve banking in its original sense isn't practiced by central banks anymore. But in the sense that they mean it, that banks have to have banks can only have to maintain a fraction of their deposits as cash. That's the fractional reserve. Yeah.
Did you want to come back on that, Alan?
Well, I certainly believe the theory that you think is wrong. But, yeah, OK.
Well, I mean...
what do you want to explain why you believe that? Because then we could answer and have a further discussion.
Really, because I can't quite understand your critique, really.
Well, but I mean, they are saying... For instance, right? Put in concrete terms again, somebody comes along and deposits £100 in the bank with a fraction reserve of 10%. That bank can then immediately lend out to somebody else or to other people a total of £900. Now, I'm saying, or we're saying, that what fraction reserve banking means is if somebody puts £100 into a bank and the fractional reserve is 10%, they can only lend £90. That's the difference between the two points of view. And if you think that somebody puts £100 in the bank, they can lend out £900. You've got to explain where that £900 comes from. The thing is made by a stroke of the pen.
Explain where it comes from. You know, the theory is that it doesn't have to come from anywhere.
Well,
I don't think it's true that the bank could do exactly what it likes. I think banks become extremely rich. I mean, I think it's created as capital, not as material capital, but as money capital. And the advantage of the banks and the reason they become so very rich, and then they have so much money, they don't know what to do with it, so they give the higher employees absolutely vast bonuses and so on. And my understanding is that they get this vast amount of money, whereas the rest of us had to work jolly hard to get a little bit of money. They can, in effect, create money out of nothing. They can't just spend that, but they can lend it and get interest on it. And because it is this huge fraction, the interest on it is really very substantial. And they do that for more or less no effort. I mean, obviously there is a bureaucratic effort, and you have to employ a few quants and so on. Well, this is speculation. That's
It's not just banks that make lots of money. Other companies, mining companies landholding companies, they also make money, and they also can pay sometimes big bonuses to their to the top. It's not just your theory is that banks are somehow got a way of making profits quicker and easier way than any other industry.
Well, I think that is true.
Well, I mean, let's go back to the concrete example for a second. Supposing you're a bank, and then somebody deposits £100, and you make a loan of £900 to them, to somebody else. That person then comes along and says, "I want my £900." You haven't got £900 to give them.
You collapse, and it's happened. Of course, it's happened many times, and you know, history.
No.
It happens every. I mean, you're a Marxist.
Yeah, but why would a bank collapse? I mean, I've got some. A bank did collapse in England. Only a small bank, if you can find it, on the south coast somewhere. I mean, why would it collapse if they could just? Why don't they just create money out of thin air?
The reason they collapse, I think, is that because you have the bust.
Because what?
Boom and bust.
Boom and bust.
Yeah. But I mean...
I mean, it's been happening since...
Yeah, but boom... Yeah, okay, century. I mean... Yeah.
Since the South Sea Bubble, at least.
Yeah, but the reason...
It's been going on before that.
Yeah, but you're assuming that all booms and busts are purely monetary things. But in fact, they're industrial cycles, you know, it's to do with production. I mean, this present crisis when did it start? 2006, 2007, 2008 was caused by people in America over-investing, over-producing houses, which banks had advanced the money to build. But when when the housing boom burst, the banks didn't get their interest. We said done all sorts of things, wasn't converted into securities and sold and so on. So because the interest wasn't coming,
I don't think the physical houses were the problem.
Well, I think they were.
The money was lent to people irresponsibly, and then people were unable to pay back.
Well, yes. But I mean, there is. I mean, I haven't got the evidence with me because I didn't know we'd have to talk on this. But there have been studies done which show that America isn't like England, where you lend a mortgage not to build a house so much as to buy a house which already exists. In America, they build houses. And I've seen films of whole empty rows of houses, which in fact have been demolished by the local municipality and so on. So I mean, there was a physical overproduction of houses in America, and of course, when the people didn't have enough money to buy all the houses that had been produced. So the anticipated, to come back to the first point I made, the anticipated income, interest income out of letting these houses or selling these houses didn't materialise, and that's what caused problems for the banks. That's what sparked it off. It wasn't a purely monetary financial crisis. And in fact, to come back to the question that was raised over here, who has got an interest in bashing the bankers? It's the rest of the capitalist class, the rest of the capitalist corporation, because they've been forced to bail out the banks, and they don't like it. So it's not a dispute which we need to get in involved in. So the bankers are nasty, the bankers are naughty, the bankers have been greedy, and they should be punished. I mean, they're just one section of the people who are making profits out of the profit system. So it comes back to what we're saying, that it's not just nationalising the banks or controlling the banks or monetary reform as the solution. The solution is to get rid of the whole system of production for profit, which causes crises